The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Some of you guys may be looking for the panel discussion. There is a panel discussion, but it's not here. It's in Caribbean 4. On the other hand, if you guys have really good questions, we might just make an impromptu panel. So, you know, if you want that. And in fact, I thought we might steal all these sheets of paper. You know, we could maybe write some questions down just for fun, pass them to the front. See, if you want, feel free. Okay. I think I've got a clicker here. Well, my name is Ravi Jain, and this is a presentation on natural philosophy and natural science. And again, if you're looking for the panel discussion, I think it's in Caribbean 4. But if you're not, I hope you enjoy this one. I thought, since this is my first time ever being at ACCS, I'd love to just take a moment to introduce myself. And it's nice to meet a few of you guys as well. It's nice to see some friendly faces out there that I've known and have just met. I thought I would start by telling you a little bit about my journey in teaching science and mathematics. And it begins with being born. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, my grandmother is from Saline, Michigan, a little town in Michigan where I understand we have a Christian classical school, so I'd like to see it someday. But I moved down to Florida when I was 7, and I grew up in Tampa. I went to a mix of private and public schools, then went on to Davidson College in North Carolina. After graduating from Davidson, came back to Tampa, taught mathematics for a year at a Christian school, Seminole Presbyterian, for those of you that are from around here. And I went to seminary. And I worked at some churches and went to seminary, went overseas for a little bit, and thought I was interested in church planting overseas and thinking about how God's kingdom extends through the church. Over the course of some internships and experience and being on staff at churches, I thought, I'm not sure this is my calling. So as I finished up seminary, I came back to teaching. And I ended up teaching at the Geneva School. So this time, it wasn't just a Christian school, it was a Christian classical school. And as a young recent seminary graduate, I was thinking, you know, what can I do with my life to invest in God's kingdom that, you know, is particular to me and my talents? And I realized that teaching at a Christian classical school is a great way to invest in the kingdom of God. And especially, I felt like natural science and mathematics had not, there's just a lot of work to be done. And so I thought, why don't I take my seminary experience, all of what I learned there, and pour it into thinking about what a thoroughly, deeply Christian mathematics and natural science looks like. And I started doing that for a few years, and I kind of decided that I liked it. And so transition went from thinking about church planting overseas to just kind of really digging in into what mathematics and science might look like at a Christian classical school. So I've been teaching at Geneva for about 10 years, one of the things that I really like about Christian classical schools is we get to talk about things like Doug Wilson was talking about today, the paideia of God, paideia curiae. How does it all fit together as an integrated whole? And so some of the things that I've done along the way that you guys might enjoy getting to know about me, just for background, is my strategy after a few years became, let's think about some integrated classes. And this isn't necessarily for everybody, but just so you know what I've been doing, after my third year teaching at Geneva, I decided, because they brought me on to teach kind of the upper level maths and sciences, so like AP things and stuff like that. So I thought, why don't I see if we can turn this to get some more meaning and nourishment out of it. And so the first thing I did was I taught a junior class called the Scientific Revolution. So we brought it together as a combined double class for juniors. And this isn't necessarily what everybody should do. I'm just so you can get a little bit more of my background. When I say a double class, what it means is that I had them for both pre-calculus and I had them for physics. So I said, why do we have these things separated? There's so much overlap in the material, let's bring them together. So we teach pre-calculus with elements of calculus in that junior class, and we teach physics mechanics with a lot of calculus, to be honest. So in fact, they do sit for the AP exam at the end of that year. Sometimes with more success than others. So, you know, it's a chain. It's a ball and chain that not everybody needs. So just, I know there's lots of different opinions on AP, and it's, I think there's good reason to have lots of different opinions on that. At any rate, this is kind of some backbones of that class, that double class. But the thing that I think is more interesting is that I tell the story of the Scientific Revolution. And so we brought the class together because I thought that would, there's a good bit of overlap in the material. But beyond that, they're intertwined in their birth. The birth of calculus and the birth of modern physics, or, you know, Newtonian physics, are this. It's part of the same story. The calculus was developed to solve problems in the physics. And so the thesis of the junior class is, how did we get to Newton's universal law of gravitation? And so we start with the ancient Greeks, and actually even the biblical narrative of creation, because God's mandates to us play into that quite a bit, into how we do science. And then it culminates in this, how did it all come together in Newton's universal law? Now, we do it at a high level, and that allows us to actually stop at the universal law of gravitation their junior year. We pick up the theme their senior year. And by the way, I should mention that the junior class is elective. It's an elective track in the sense that about 40% of our student body takes it. So it's not for everybody because it's taught at the more aggressive level, although we also did for a number of years have this at just a regular level as well, which I thought was a good thing. The senior year, it's again perhaps about half of the kids or about half the kids or so that go into the junior class will usually convert into joining me in the senior class. We've got four great options our senior year for science, so you know that's about what you'd expect, something like that. The relativity class was originally also a combined double class for seniors. It's changed a little bit now, and we can talk about that more later. But if you think about it, like what I do is I teach four different courses, but they're only in two separate double classes. In my senior class, I teach Calculus 1 and 2. They take the APBC test at the end of that, and Physics, Electricity, and Magnetism with Calculus. And they take another AP test there. And that all leads into the story of the theory of relativity. And so I think the more distinctive thing, anybody can teach AP. It's hard, and perhaps it's not worth it. But I mean, let's have the other discussion. The other discussion is that I think the story of the Scientific Revolution as a thesis for the junior class and the story of the theory of relativity as a thesis for the senior class has been really fantastic. It's really the story of the Second Scientific Revolution, the narrative of how we get to the Second Scientific Revolution. So I give you this background so you guys understand where I'm coming from. Can this be implemented at any level? I think it can be implemented at any level of difficulty, whatever you feel comfortable with. The question that I want to bring out today is, how do we get to something bigger than just a cookbook class that's kind of about, that's just about mastering equations? How do we get to the meaning? So let's talk about some theoretical background. There's my personal background, and nice to meet you too, you know. So some theoretical background. I want to make sure to leave some time for questions at the end. So I've decided not to go into too much depth or too many details here with all this theoretical stuff. So if any of you guys have more questions about the theoretical stuff, feel free to just pen them down, jot them down so that we can talk at the end. But I've realized, you know, I could get so excited about little minuscule details, and most people just, you know, aren't interested. But let me talk a little bit about the theoretical background. And if you want to bend my ear later, I'd love to. In that, we're going to talk about problems with science and scientism, natural philosophy, and how natural philosophy is bigger than modern science, wonder, work, wisdom, and worship, and how the arts of language will naturally reappear in natural science if you do it properly. The trivium, how the trivium comes back in natural science. So this is going to be the theoretical background part, and then this will be essentially the beginning of the talk, and at the end of the talk, we're going to get into the practical how do I do this kind of stuff. So who here has heard the word scientism? Is scientism a familiar word? How many of you guys like scientism? Secretly, you're going to go home and be like, oh, that's great. We need a revival of scientism. I'm usually preaching to the choir here. We all know that there's a problem. Science is a fantastic. I think it's actually birthed by Christian ideals, Christian motives. But there's been a move over the past 100 to 150 years that has said science is the only way of knowing reality. It's the only way of knowing truth, and everything else should stand back and get out of its way. One of the chief trumpeters of this is Richard Dawkins, of course. Scientific beliefs are supported by evidence, and they get results. Myths and faiths are not and do not, Richard Dawkins would say. This is typical. And on the other hand, it's also, it's almost somewhat pedantic and boring at this point. You'd heard it so much. You thought, really? I thought this went out with the early 20th century. But, you know, no, it's actually still the way a lot of people think. And I think, more importantly, and a lot of times, it's the worldview that our textbooks imply. And unless we're very careful to be conscious about how we teach math and science, sometimes we accidentally leave this impression with our kids, too. Hopefully never on purpose, but sometimes science has this impression. And certainly this is out there in the culture. But listen to somebody else, Sir Peter Medawar. It is not to science, therefore, but to metaphysics, imaginative literature, or religion that we must turn for answers to questions having to do with first and last things. Neither men are Christians, but they have very different views on the role of science in contemporary life. I wonder how many of you know who Sir Peter Medawar is. Does anybody know who Sir Peter Medawar is? He wrote a book called The Limits of Science, and I believe that's where I found this quote. But Peter Medawar is somebody that John Lennox turned me on to. He also, in a way, turned me on to Richard Dawkins. I was so quick to dismiss Richard Dawkins and then to realize that John Lennox feels like this is where the culture debate still is. Richard Dawkins has a platform. He said, so Ravi, have you read Peter Medawar? He is fantastic, really. Peter Medawar was a Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize in 1960 for his work on tissue transplantation. And both Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould thinks that this man is one of the most brilliant science writers alive. It is very interesting that Peter Medawar is not a Christian, and yet still thinks that this idea that, you know, scientism is just old news. Even by 1960, he thought it was old news. And yet a man like Richard Dawkins, who respects Medawar so much, still doesn't act as if people like Medawar don't exist. Clearly, both are men of science, but think that science has a very different role in contemporary life. Science and scientism is a problem. I think we know that. So how do we get around this? Well, I thought when I was a young teacher, the best way to do this is to go back in time to see what science was like before we found this problem? And usually I think this problem, scientism, is associated with positivism, which happened around the early 20th century, but late 19th century as well. And you start looking back and you realize, wow, they use different words for stuff that we call science now. What words did they use back when they thought this all got along better, when they thought that faith, Christian faith, and natural science were harmonious? What kinds of words did they use? Well, it turns out they used the word natural philosophy. And if you start looking back, not just to, you know, the 1870s, I mean, the word is still in use in the 1900s, but you used to look back to the, not just the 1800s, but the 1700s, 1600s, 1300s, 1000, you start realizing, wow, this word has been around for thousands of years. Why did we get rid of this? What happened? What's the story with that? Natural philosophy is bigger than modern natural science. I think it's actually a reductionistic move. It's a move to try to kick out faith, to kick out imagination, to kick out meaning and purpose out of the ideas of the natural world, out of our conception of the natural world, and reduce all of reality to mechanism that's meaningless, meaningless mechanism. I think that's really what's going on when we start to eliminate this term natural philosophy and limit our usage to natural science. The main thing I want to say is that natural philosophy is bigger than modern natural science. And people, even, you know, contemporary physicists know this. I think many of you guys in here should know the name Werner Heisenberg. Werner Heisenberg, anybody want to mention to me what he did? Yes. Sure, the Heisenberg Uncertainty Principle, for one. He's one of the chief founders of what? Very good, quantum mechanics, right? Heisenberg is one of the chief founders of quantum mechanics. And yet, listen to this quote. A chief founder of modern physics, all of our computers are built upon the intellectual edifice of quantum mechanics. And yet, listen to what he says. I was coming to the increasing conclusion that I could make no further progress in modern physics without a greater understanding of Greek natural philosophy. Isn't that fascinating? Something bigger than just, you know, plug and chug, something bigger than Mr. Grad Grind. I agree, and this is another interesting quote. This is from a little bit earlier, a few hundred years before. But what I find interesting about this is that these men were on opposing sides of a different argument, but they both agreed on this point. Both Leibniz, one of the co-founders of calculus, and Locke, one of the founders of empiricism and important in our American story, had this to say: I agree that the whole of natural philosophy will never be perfectly a science for us. Now, it's interesting if we dig into what that word science means, what it meant for Leibniz, what it meant for different people. And this is not probably the venue or the time to do that, but I think we could get into a good discussion. This is something that my colleague and I have been talking about quite a bit, and start to understand what it is that natural philosophy, why it's bigger. Consider again Sir Peter Medawar, the imaginative exploit, for example, that generates a scientific hypothesis was regarded by Shelley as cognate with poetic invention. Do we have a place for that? Do we have a place for emphasizing the role of poetic invention in the way we teach natural science? Natural philosophy includes questions of meaning, purpose, and value, which are outlawed by modern natural science. Consider that even the atheist Thomas Nagel considers this a problem. When you've got atheists lining up saying, yeah, this is kind of a problem, maybe, you know, and they're kind of taking your side, time to rethink things. If you guys haven't read this book, it's probably hard to see. Thomas, Mind and Cosmos by Thomas Nagel. You want to hear the subtitle? It's really good. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Robin. Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. Published by Oxford University Press, 2012. And again, Thomas Nagel is an atheist. Interesting, isn't it? Yes. Mind and Cosmos. You're welcome. So the point only being that natural philosophy, that our kids need a grounding in something bigger than just a reductionistic version of the natural world. They need to engage the natural world with their whole being, natural philosophy. the pursuit of wisdom, the love of wisdom that is pertaining to the natural world. As we do this, I think some things will be recovered, and I think these are things that you guys are all interested in as well as I am. Wonder, work, wisdom, and worship in natural science. And I think, of course, in mathematics as well, we should recover these things that sometimes the wonder, the wisdom, and the worship have been pushed to the sides, and only the work is what we leave for the kids. But I think we all know that we want this. Philosophy begins in wonder, says Aristotle. So if natural philosophy is our goal, how are we founding our investigations of the natural world in wonder? I said that I think the story of science actually begins in the garden. Fill the earth and subdue it, Genesis 1. Work is something that is part of our Christian story. Why is it that natural science is birthed in medieval Christian Europe in so many ways? I think a lot of it has to do with the vision that Christians had of the goodness of the created order, and that the created order is good. It's okay to get your hands dirty and work. It's okay to find useful things. I don't think that wisdom is mostly about usefulness, but it's okay that if some things you know are useful, that's great. We gotta all do things that help people and benefit others. Get wisdom. Do I really need to argue for wisdom? Proverbs, just take any chapter of Proverbs. I thought, well, Proverbs 4 says get wisdom 3 times, I think, so we can say Proverbs 4. Proverbs 1 through 9, all of them work. Not only does it say get wisdom in these, but I think the fascinating thing to me is Socrates' vision of a philosopher, somebody who loved wisdom, is said earlier by Proverbs, isn't it? Cherish her. You know, do everything you can to find wisdom. The idea of loving wisdom is not antithetical to Christianity. I mean, it's part of Christianity. So the philosopher, the goal of natural philosophy, the love of wisdom pertaining to the natural world, is right up in the center of Christian doctrine, in my opinion. And how does worship figure into this? Well, isn't it fascinating that Christ is called the wisdom of God? Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Fascinating to see these things. But how? Okay, Ravi, this is great. Nice to meet you. But what are you doing? You know, how do you do this stuff? Introduce a narrative component? Well, okay. Oh, oops, I answered my own question. What you do is, I think that one way to do it is to introduce a narrative component to math and science classes, including elements of history and philosophy. And we'll talk about this more in a minute. But I think this is a good strategy to intertwine all these four themes. Before we go to the tactics of the how-to of the discussion, I want to mention a little bit about the arts of language and natural science, the role of the trivium. I think the trivium actually has also been much neglected in natural science. And when you introduce a narrative component, the arts of the trivium reappear. They reappear naturally. When you start telling the story of how people came to the various stepping stones that led to the conclusion of the universal theory of gravitation. When you tell a story, there's lots of times that you have to use the arts of language, right? The trivium. Once a narrative component is introduced, the arts of language naturally reappear. What is a unity? Whenever you start talking about things, you have to actually start using language and start thinking about qualities. When you think about a tree, for example, what is a tree? Well, a tree has lots and lots of different leaves. It has maybe 5,000 leaves and, you know, a few hundred branches. It's got a trunk. It's got bark. It's got hundreds of roots. All these multi-various things yet form some unity. A tree. What is this? What is qualitatively true about a tree? I really liked what Doug had to say this morning about speaking things into existence, the words matter, the words we use to build a civilization is reenacting the process of creation. I think he's right, and I think this is what the ancients would have actually called grammar. What is the essence of a thing? Now, I know we normally and often think about grammar as the rules of language, and I don't think it's less than the rules of language. I think it's more than the rules of language. I think it includes the rules of language, but grammar, C.S. Lewis said, was everything that it goes into reading a book. And there's an if anybody, there's a lot of interesting stuff here to talk about. But for the ancients, grammar, the grammar of reality was reflected in the language that we use. And so when you started to look at why we call something a tree or why we call a person a man or how do we distinguish between a wolf and a dog, this was actually a scientific pursuit for the ancients, and they this fell under the topic of grammar. How do we use dialectic? Well, negotiating disagreements between scientists, Dawkins and Lennox for one. have any of you guys gotten the debates between Dawkins and Lennox? Aren't they? Does anybody use them in their classrooms? Oh, in Birmingham. Fantastic. And the videos that came out of that were also really good. I mean, wow, you want to energize a classroom, show them one of those videos. How do you negotiate disagreements among scientists? Leibniz and Newton co-founded the calculus, but you know they also disagreed on the nature of force. By the way, who do you think won that debate, Newton or Leibniz, on force? Raise your hand if you think it's Newton. Raise your hand if you think it's Leibniz. Oh, I didn't see any hands. You guys are too sly, aren't you? We all think that Newton won the debate on force, but it's Leibniz that won. You know, today in contemporary physics, they generally use Leibnizian concepts as opposed to Newtonian concepts when they're discussing how to solve problems in dynamics. Do you know why? Do you know what the concept that Leibniz proposed in response to Newton was? Energy. Leibniz offered energy. And he argued for energy, while Newton argued for force. Very, very interesting. At any rate, this is a discussion that I don't actually think has a just right, clear solution. I don't think you say, oh, well, force is right and energy is wrong. I think the truth is that there's kind of a constant dialectic between the two. Different camps using, you know, scientists on the continent versus scientists in England. How did they develop different traditions? But they're both working towards, I think, very, very interesting things. So dialectic, when you start telling a story, you have to get into the dialectic. Also, how to construct persuasive arguments in natural science. And if we listen to Peter Medawar, you know, it's not all mathematics. What did Peter Medawar say about hypotheses? It's poetic invention. Yeah, exactly. So I know that this might be this might take a little bit of getting used to, and the idea of how we think about the language arts reappearing in natural science might be complex, but I think that you can all see that when you start to bring in back a narrative and the history and the philosophy of the discipline, that a narrative component could appear and that the arts of language would naturally reappear. I should mention, if you guys are more interested in how these things play out, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, I'd be happy to talk with you guys some more. And I wrote about it in a book, and I'll be available tomorrow at the Classical Academic Press booth from about 11 o'clock to, I don't know, 1:30 to talk some more about it. Okay, so you might be thinking, this sounds great, but how? You guys ready for the nuts and bolts stuff? Okay, you guys, okay, good. I saw some head nods, so I'm happy. How to introduce a narrative component? Well, the first thing I'd recommend is to go easy on yourself. Baby steps. Don't think that this is something that you have to accomplish all at one time, but take each piece little by little and progress. Just grow in the process. First, you got to learn the narrative yourself. Since very few of us were taught this way, we don't know exactly that Newton, you know, and Leibniz had this argument about force and energy. It took me until it was my fifth year of teaching physics, I think, before I found out that Leibniz was arguing for energy. It was actually once I had introduced a fairly robust narrative component that I started to think, you know, I just throw this energy bit in here. I don't really talk about its history. And after starting to look into it, I was blown away. I was literally astounded that this was so serious. So it takes some time to learn the narrative yourself. And it's okay if we do baby steps on that. Find some good resources. For example, the Soul of Science. Do you guys use the Soul of Science in your classrooms? Are a number of you guys here math and science teachers? Okay. Have you guys seen this book before? Head nods. I recommend this book very highly. It is by Nancy Percy is the first author, and Charles Thaxton is the second author. And I've had students that, you know, weren't even really very interested in my classes that said, "Mr. Jane, I just have to tell you that that book is my favorite book right now of all the books I'm reading and all my, even for, you know, for fun." So it's a really good book. I've had students that have gone on to do science in college and even at the graduate level that have taken that book from high school and, you know, used it on and on. Isn't that cool? So funny. I would recommend it. People that read it tend to find that it gets better the more times you read it, and the footnotes are good. Right, Robbie? So find some good resources to help you learn the narrative yourself, and let the students sample lessons bit by bit. You know, you don't have to come up with a superstructure to get everything going. It's okay to just start a little bit. And once you start letting the kids sample lessons, at some point you'll probably be ready to develop just a small micro-narrative, is what I call it. And you can expand a micro-narrative later. In order to get you to put some more flesh on the bones of this idea of a narrative, I'm going to give you guys a few samples. And this is going to depart a little bit from, if you're looking at your conference bulletin like this, or your conference book, it's going to change a little bit, but I think it'll all be pretty similar. I'm just changing the order of the narratives, which narrative I give when. I thought I'd start with a little bit of a physics micro-narrative, and then after we do the physics micro-narrative, I'll show you what I do in my junior classes, the whole macro-narrative, the narrative that I use for the junior class altogether. And then after we do the micro-narrative for physics, the macro-narrative for physics, then I'm going to show you the biology micro-narrative that my colleague Robbie and I have been working on. It's really Robbie's baby, but he lets me babysit sometimes. So. The physics micro-narrative. If you want to get into something like this and say, okay, that's fine, how do I start? Now, you may not teach physics. You might teach chemistry. And think of this as an example of what can be done, and then think about how it might port into your discipline. We're going to give an example for two disciplines, but I've had people say, well, I teach earth science, or I teach environmental science. How does this apply there? And so I've enjoyed thinking through with different people how it applies. But this is just an example so that you guys can be thinking about how you would build in a narrative component to yourself. And first of all, I should say, along with the baby steps, is, it's kind of like that, demonstration that many of you have seen before. If you've got, you know, kind of big rocks, and then you've got pebbles and sand and water, and you want to get it all into one jar, you don't pour the sand in first, and then the pebbles, and then the big rocks. You put the big stuff in place first, and then pour the smaller stuff. Then you pour in the pebbles and the sand and the rocks, and you let things fill in, and the water. And the big things in your curriculum, there's a lot of content that we teach that are going to end up becoming like the big boulders that you have to teach, that you need to get in place. But you might be able to restructure where those boulders line up. And then the narrative component, it essentially is more like the sand and the water that fill in the interstices that you can get in. They become the connective tissue that brings everything else together, if you will. So this is a page from my physics and macro narrative, but what I've highlighted is just a few things in yellow that would be a minimum way to get started with a micro-narrative. How do you dabble in this stuff? How do you dip your toe into it? I know this didn't come out on the handout. I thought it'd be good to have a few questions there, you know, that you didn't have in advance. But basically, I think that good micronarrative for physics is a Kepler, Galileo, and Newton sequence. So if you begin with Johannes Kepler and then move to Galileo, or even start either way you start, but how both of these guys work together, and they come up with so much of the important discoveries that leads to Isaac Newton. These three people work really well to get the crux of the universal law of gravitation, to get just a crux of a narrative sequence. If you think about these as three main people, then some more narrative content can go around it. So what did Kepler do? Kepler gathered celestial laws from Brahe's data, from Tycho Brahe's data. Kepler's known for his three laws. Galileo said that bodies fall with the same acceleration. And then he also came up with his kinematics equations. And then Newton looked at Kepler's celestial mechanics and also looked at Galileo's terrestrial or earthly kinematics and said, how do these laws in the heavens match up with the laws on the earth? And so if you've given the kids some time to think about how it was that Kepler came up with his laws in the heavens, and then given the kids some time to think about how Galileo came up with his laws governing the motion of things on the earth, and then give the kids, let the kids work and struggle and kind of think about the process of how it was that Newton synthesized these two. We tend to talk about these things, but we often talk about them more deductively, as if we show them how Kepler's laws are a consequence of Newton's universal law of gravitation. But the truth is that Kepler's laws preceded Newton's universal law. And we often just kind of omit the process altogether, as if it all sprung fully formed from the mind of Newton. So this is a little page from my macro narrative, and I've just highlighted a few things that I think would be crucial to get for a micro narrative. Let me dig a little bit deeper into those things that I've highlighted here. In the physics micronarrative, Kepler's third law is plays directly into the proof for the universal law of gravitation. Galileo's naturally accelerated motion, that things of different masses all fall to the Earth with the constant acceleration, and his kinematics equations. Then Newton tries to develop his laws of motion. F equals MA is familiar to all you guys, and I'm sure anybody that teaches physics teaches that centripetal force is mv squared over r. And it's all these equations, it's primarily Newton's Kepler's third law and Newton's centripetal force, but the other equations Newton uses in his proof as well. But it's primarily just these equations that lead to Newton's universal law of gravitation. So what we're talking about here is not necessarily a lot of material, but it's a different way of dealing with the same material. Who here does teach physics? Could you raise your hand? Just a few of us? Okay. So my guess is that all of you guys teach these equations. Is that true? Yeah. It's not stuff that we don't teach. It's just a little bit different thinking about letting the kids reason up to the universal law as opposed to telling them, okay, this is the universal law and see what flows out of it. The inductive process, or the process of inference, the process of gathering evidence, how do you come up with those hypotheses? How do you teach genius? How do you teach poetic invention? If a hypothesis is like that poetic invention, how do you teach that? And that's what I fear that we're losing with our kids at some level, is that we're never allowing them to think through the whole history of how this works. We're teaching them, and you know, I would say, I teach a lot of the higher level kids because it's elective, my track is elective, so a lot of my kids are more likely to go into careers in math and science than others, but still only perhaps half of my kids go into careers in math and science. So why are we teaching everybody all this stuff if it's only because they're gonna use it someday? They're not gonna use calculus someday. You know, I had a guy that works at Lockheed Martin who teaches calculus and physics. He did his postdoctoral research at CERN, brilliant guy, runs a team of engineers. He said, Ravi, I gotta tell you something. We don't use calculus in my job. I said, oh, okay. Well, I think it's perhaps a lie. If we tell students, hey, we're teaching you guys this because you might use it someday. I think we've got to teach it to them because it's formative. It shapes who they are. It helps them learn how to think. And if we're missing that whole process of how do you come up with these things, you know, then we're missing the boat. We're missing the whole point of why we do science and math as well. So the way we look at how we teach this stuff, a process of reasoning from evidence to conclusions, reasoning from the phenomena to causes for the phenomena, I think is really the helpful thing that following the history does for you here. Now, another thing I should say is that you can get into the writers themselves, the primary sources. You can get into people like Isaac Newton. He has got a fantastic scholium at the end of his Principia Mathematica, which talks about Lord God omnipotent. Or if you read Pascal's Pensées, Pascal was a physicist of the 1600s at this time, plays into the whole narrative. If you read Pascal's Pensées, he sews a prayer into his jacket that he carried with him at all times, saying, you know, Jesus Christ, your God and my God, fire, 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 not the God of the philosophers, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, it's passionate stuff. Brilliant scientist, brilliant mathematician. But by actually reading what these guys wrote themselves, I think you can get a lot of meaning and purpose out of what they say. So you can get stuff from Galileo, from Two New Sciences, from Kepler and Harmonies of the World, and from Newton and his Principia Mathematica. Kepler, by the way, talked about Jesus all over the place in his science and Harmonies of the World. It's very interesting to see how these guys write. Not everybody uses primary sources, and you should go with them slowly. Over the years, I've developed a reader, and some of the stuff, I would say most of the stuff is primary sources that I use. We don't read it all. It's just more of like a handbook that the kids can go to when I want have a primary source reading that I want them to turn to. And so this is for my juniors, the Scientific Revolution. And so lots of primary sources in here that they can get to for me to help me tell them the story and for them to read. Be careful with primary sources. You can easily overload your students. But on the other hand, it's a great way to get them into some really meaty stuff and to help them realize that faith and science are not at all opposed, but are often working together. There are some other helpful secondary sources. The Birth of a New Physics will just help you get the narrative. The Scientific Revolution and the Origins of Modernity, the Origins of Modern Science, is a really interesting book for the big picture of meaning and what's going on in the Scientific Revolution. But it's very good, but it's very rich and dense. It's short, though, as well. And then The Soul of Science by Nancy Percy is also there. Now, I've given you a potential physics micro-narrative. Now, the physics macro-narrative, just so you get a sense of what you can do with this over time, is you can have a lot more room to develop the story. And you can think about the content that you want to teach and the story in which that content fits. And so that's why I say don't do this too quickly. Take baby steps, because you'll enjoy it doing the narrative. But the thing is that the kids still need to get their skills. You still need to cover content. There's still standardized tests. There's still colleges. There's still all that stuff. And you don't want to have a revolution in your class and then the parents get upset and then they say, never do that again. You know, it's just one of those things. You got to take it slow. Make sure it's working for you. Make sure the kids like it. Take it slow. See how it goes. Over time, you can figure out how to tell the story of each of the theorems you use, you know, how to tell the process of invention of all these things. But when you get into this, you get into natural questions of meaning and purpose and how does this stuff all fit together? How does it fit with Christian faith? You can see that besides what I normally think of as empirical, taking observations, and the rational, putting things together in deductive systems or logical systems or mathematical systems, I also have a place for the poetic. And so that poetic process of invention, where do these hypotheses come from? When's the first time the word force was used in the modern context? Also, what are the convictions that are changing the way scientists think about the world? Galileo said that Mathematics is the language with which God created the universe. You know, that was kind of a new idea on the scene? That the mathematization of the world picture was kind of new in the 1600s. I don't mean to say it was never there. It's Pythagorean in origin in lots of ways. But it had fallen out of favor. And so what Galileo is doing is bringing back an old idea. But that is a major part of the story. And if you miss that part of the story of the scientific revolution, then you've missed a lot of what's happening in the 1600s. So the poetic, this is the way I keep track of my narrative, having an empirical, a rational, and a poetic column so that the students don't get too confused. There's certainly lots of advances that come from, hey, we just made a new discovery. I never knew that there was a black swan in Australia. How cool is that? A new discovery led to a reevaluation of the theory. And so there's lots of room for empirical advances, but there's also room for rational advances. We've got the same evidence that they had, but we put it together in a different way because we developed calculus, something like that. But leaving a column for poetic allows the kids to realize that it's not all just about facts and observations and mathematics. Okay. We've got about 15 minutes left, and I'd like to try to close up this next section about 5 minutes so that we can leave 10 minutes for questions. Does that sound good, you guys? This next section is a really exciting section to me. This is about the micronarrative of biology. And if you guys are having any troubles with your students, if you have different contingencies at your school that have different, you know, kind of positions on age of the earth, the theory of evolution, how that fits in with the biology curriculum, if you have different contingencies, and almost all schools do, then I think the narrative approach will really help you solve what is often a political issue. And so if you guys are interested, or if you guys do have that problem, pay close attention here. And like I said, a lot of this, there's some really exciting things. I'll mention more later. I think the best way to handle this is to develop a Lyell, Darwin, and Critics of Darwin micronarrative to start with. Robbie Andreessen has been doing fantastic work here at the Geneva School. Robbie, stand up for a minute. If anybody wants more information on a biology micronarrative or narrative, talk to Robbie afterwards. I think he might even have, do you have anything to give people if they're interested? If anybody, you know, he might have some handouts or whatever. But Lyell is a geologist that was very interested in the organization of the of fossils and geological layers and things like that. And he was trying to understand the causes that made these structures. And so it's really about the time of Lyell that we end up having the discussion about what's the age of the Earth. One of the things that Lyell suggested is uniformitarianism, or that it's the uniform processes that are now in existence, now continually working, that caused the structures that we see in the geological record. And uniformitarianism was the conviction of Charles Lyell. Now, it wasn't the only position out there. Another position was catastrophism, that the features that we see in the geological record are due to catastrophes. And this, I think, falls into the poetic column, the column of, you know, there are two different positions to take on what the story of causes are, how causes work. And if you go with uniformitarianism, it's probably going to lead you to conclude that the Earth is old. And if you think that there are catastrophes that cause these geological features, then it might cause you to think that the Earth is not as old as the uniformitarians do. But I think the interesting thing is that I think this discussion you can actually really have with the students and say, you know, and there are many of you that may have different positions on this, and your families and churches may. Go ahead and talk with them. This is an organization that connects to this controversy or this discussion today in contemporary thought. This is where the controversy comes from. So I think when you think about it as a narrative component, it naturally comes up, the discussion naturally comes up. You give people a chance to think about it a little bit and then go on, talk to their pastors and parents about it more. It's Darwin building on this idea of change in the fossil record in what appeared to be long periods of time that led him to his idea of natural selection on random variation. And then a few years later published on theory of common descent. So I think clearly, you know, Dobzhansky, if you guys know that name, says that all of biology is unintelligible without evolution. He says this in the 50s or 60s. Clearly today, the dominant paradigm for biology is evolution. Now, in the 50s, you know, in the 1800s, it wasn't. And so I think that they were able to hold a lot of things together without the theory of evolution. But the point is that most biology textbooks that you use, and if kids go off to study biology, it's going to be organized around the theory of evolution. The kids have to interact with it at a pretty deep level. And so you've got to give, I think, the argument for why Darwin reasoned from the evidence to his conclusion about the theory of evolution. And as you do that, you have an opportunity again to say, well, so Darwin, you know, part of his poetic convictions is were that there's uniform causation, suggests the Earth is very old, there's change over time, mechanist. There are a number of other assumptions. Robbie can talk to you at greater length about these. And so he makes his argument. Now, the other thing, though, and there are Christians that hold this position. There are theistic evolutionists that hold this position, and I think you can say to the class, there's many of you guys out there might have parents or come from a family that has this position. So feel free to go talk now with your pastor and your family and discuss it more. You can connect the narrative component to the contemporary discussion. And then the next part that I think is the best micro-narrative for biology. Now, there's a macro-narrative to be told here, too, which, again, is much bigger than the micro-narrative. The macro-narrative will lead to things like neo-Darwinism, things like the ENCODE project, Human Genome Project. So what Robbie does is really quite impressive as far as the narrative structure of his class. But if you want a biggest bang for your buck really get into a narrative, the micro-narrative quickly, I think this Lyell Darwin, the critics of Darwin sequence is fantastic because the critics of Darwin are also quite interesting. Agassiz, the Mendelians, and Kurt Gödel are just three that I've chosen. Agassiz was a Harvard biologist. He was, I think, head of the department at Harvard and the most eminent biologist at the time. You know, and he was a person that said natural selection on random variation is not consistent with the fossil record in geological time. And you can point to Agassiz and say, students, okay, now this is a critique of Darwin at the time, and that connects with some people in contemporary discussion that believe this. The Mendelians put a little bit of pressure on the Darwinian mechanism. And then you have Kurt Gödel, which said the origin of this genetic variation is still unaccounted for with reasonable possibility. And I love this quote by Kurt Gödel. The quote by Kurt Gödel I've been quite surprised by some of these things over the past few years. Kurt Gödel was one of the world's leading mathematicians in the 20th century. Was anybody at John Mays's presentation this morning? John Mays mentioned him in his presentation of mathematics just as one of the big 20th century figures. There's perhaps no bigger figure than Kurt Gödel in mathematics. And this is what he said. One disproval will consist in a mathematical theorem to the effect that the formation within geological times of a human body by the laws of physics, starting from a random distribution of the elementary particles in the field, is as unlikely as the separation by chance of the atmosphere into its components. Isn't that mind-blowing? This is a guy in the 1960s, 1950s, considered to be, perhaps he worked with Einstein at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Studies, literally perhaps the world's foremost mathematician that was a critic of Darwinism. Now, it's just interesting. You know, I think the point is that we have constituencies that believe all of these different things, that have debates over the age of the Earth, that are theistic evolutionists, and that are critics of Darwin. Now, all these things have empirical evidence for them. They have rational places where they have rational consistency, and there's convictions, poetic convictions. My point is not to maybe move your own needle on this question. My point is to ask you, how do you teach that? How do you teach it so you're not teaching positivistic science? How do you teach it so that you're teaching natural philosophy? And my suggestion, maybe I've gotten under your skin a little bit now, my suggestion is that if you teach the story, if you tell the story, if you tell the narrative, man, it opens up a world of possibilities and perhaps will even solve some of your problems. there, I listed some primary sources for biology micronarrative, but you can talk more, again, with Robbie. He'll be much more helpful than I will be. And then some secondary sources as well for the biology micronarrative. How do you introduce a narrative component? Baby steps. Remember I told you baby steps 3 years from now. Don't feel bad if you haven't made much progress. Just do it a little bit at a time. Learn the narrative yourself. Find some good resources. Let the students sample things bit by bit, not all at a time. Develop a micro-narrative that can be expanded later. You might want to read more our book. This book was just released last year by Classical Academic Press. It's called The Liberal Arts Tradition, A Philosophy of Christian Classical Education. And if you're interested in, you know, developing a narrative or the difference between natural philosophy and natural science, I go into much more depth on that. In this, I just kind of wanted to give you, you know, a little bit of theoretical background and a little bit of practical. That goes into more depth. But again, we'll be available at the Classical Academic Press booth tomorrow from like 11 to 1:30 or so. And we can talk more with you there about it. But my physics narrative is actually in that book, so you can see a lot more about it as well. Why do we do this stuff? I think there are benefits to it. Wonder, work, wisdom, and worship. I think you can see that there are a lot of ways that the kids might be more engaged in this kind of a narrative context. I may have even gotten some of your blood rolling today. Recognize the importance of the arts of the trivium, that the arts of language naturally reemerge. It doesn't diminish the rigor of natural science. Some of you guys might be thinking, yeah, but I've got all this content to teach. Well, I do too. I've got lots of content to teach. But there, you can teach the content within a story. That's all. You know, and figure out the narrative framework that you can use. And at the end of the day, don't you want your kids to not to confront Richard Dawkins and the and those new atheists? We had a student that was doing lab. He was a Duke physics major, and in his first year at the lab, some kids were talking about Christians and how dumb they were or something like that. And he said, well, actually, you know, James Clerk Maxwell was a Christian, and he came up with the four laws we use every day in, you know, our electricity and magnetism class. And they were stunned, you know. But just the fact that he was so familiar with the narrative that he could own that conversation, you know, it was pretty cool. And I think his professor was even impressed. So those are the kinds of things we want to see our kids do. And in order to do that, in order to have these conversations, I think we need to kick it up a notch. Okay, guys, we've got a few minutes for questions left. Yes, sir.
Maybe it's not quite as intense here with your subjects, but is there anything comparable?
Well, I think that's a great question. And it's not as though I have something to give you or Robbie has something to give you on chemistry, but what I would say is focus on Lavoisier. I think there's a couple things. What I'd say is the alchemical tradition leading up to Lavoisier is very interesting. And we miss the importance of alchemy if we think that it was only about magic and stuff. Yeah, there is a lot of gathering data. There is a lot of empirical observations. There is a lot of attempts at systemization in alchemy. And so if you get a good book, A History of Chemistry, that has a meaty section on alchemy, you'll figure out a lot of the story yourself. And then I think most of modern chemistry hinges on Lavoisier. Now, we tend to think that modern chemistry hinges on quantum physics and, you know, Pauli, exclusion principle, all that kind of stuff, the periodic table. You know, you might just say, how do we get the periodic table? That might be the thesis of your chemistry class, you know, and reason up to Mendeleev. Like, I think it's interesting if you see a few of the different chemistry periodic tables. They change over the 1800s, and you get kind of elementary chemistry periodic tables that have only 18 elements, and then you get more advanced ones. That might be a great way to do this in chemistry. So we're thinking about it, but I don't have anything kind of right out of the bat to give you. There is a third guy at our school. He's in Calvin College right now, but he hasn't been able to. He does a little bit, but not quite as much to be able to share at this point. Yeah.
Well, I don't want this to sound too self-serving.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And one
of
the chapters is the Christian history of chemistry, and it's actually pretty interesting. It's at the Trinity Classical Academy.
That's awesome, Mark.
So that wasn't my plan to come in here, but since you asked, I wanted to let you know. And one of the chapters goes, it's brief, though, but it gives you the foundation.
That is fantastic. I'm so thrilled to hear that. Yes, sir. You're welcome. Ernst Mayr is not a Christian. He's considered the dean of 20th century evolutionary biology, I think is the term that's used for him. So you're not going to get somebody that's more antagonistic, I guess you could say, to... Well, I guess these are great sparring partners. Stephen Mayr, Darwin's Doubt, is actually a very, very good book. I've been quite impressed with it, and it's getting a lot of praise. So Darwin's Doubt helps you get the narrative of the critics of Darwinism, but if you need to get the narrative of Darwinism so that your kids don't fumble with it, they should know it. Whether they conclude that that Darwin's theory is a good theory or whether they conclude it's a bad theory, they need to know Darwin's theory, because they're certainly going to get, if they ever get into a discussion and don't know it, then they're going to be pummeled. So Ernst Mayr's This is Biology is a really good narrative of the story of biology. So, yes.
Will you share, I think you have some traditions of introducing your junior class to the calculus, and I think that it would be wonderful for them to hear about that.
Thanks, Robbie. Sure. We call it the secrets of the calculus, so first of all. They don't know. In my class, the way we do math, so this has been mostly about science, but I do math in a similar way, and I want them to reason up to the derivative algorithm for the power rule, and I want them to reason up to the integral algorithm. So we tend to think that the algorithms are the math. No, the math is kind of a much broader thing where there's proofs involved and all kinds of in deep reasoning, and the algorithm is just the tip of the iceberg. So I try to move them along that path, and when they get just to the point where they can taste it, it's like everything has crystallized for them, but they haven't yet figured out that there's a really easy way to solve this problem, and it's an algorithm. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? The derivative of 5x, or the derivative of x squared is 2x, and so I make them do it the really hard, long way, and actually a lot of the class is structured so it's building up with Pascal's triangle and all this stuff to the derivative and the integral algorithms. And then when we get right to the cusp, and it's like they're about to have that premonition or they just have had it, then I have the seniors come in and throw pillowcases over their head. We take them out, and then we bring them back in with candles, and the room is dark. And Robbie, oh my goodness, have you taken calculus, Robbie? Oh my, I don't know if I should be sharing the secrets of the calculus. How many of you guys know calculus? Oh, I just gave away some of the secrets. Oh, my goodness. At any rate, the point is that we have an induction ceremony to the secrets of the calculus at that point. And they've got to, we pull the pillowcase off their head with candles, and the seniors say, are you willing to uphold the oath of secrecy to the calculus? You will not give away the secrets to minds who are not yet ready. It's a very Pythagorean kind of process. And it's designed to be a Christian Pythagorean thing, but the goal is to get them to think about to have some joy in the attainment that they've received, and to realize it's worth something. It's impressive, Yes, Grant.
Well, I was just going to say, Roddy, that I'm glad you didn't do that to me. You just did me. I'm going to teach you calculus in 20 minutes with doodles, which you did, and I can't do division. No one can.
Thank you, Grant. I appreciate that. I think we're about out of time. Are there any other questions? If there are any more questions, feel free to ask me. I'll be around here today. Tomorrow, again, talk to Robbie if you're interested in biology. And tomorrow at the Classical Academic Press booth from about 11 o'clock to maybe 1:30 or so, we'll be around to answer questions. And also some more people from Geneva will be there if you're interested in how other things at Geneva work, lower school or other things like that. Thank you very much.